What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Sunday marks 6 months of this iteration of Israel's siege or genocide in Gaza. We will spend the full hour in reflection and analysis. Our guest this morning is Mohanad Ayash, a policy analyst for Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and a professor of sociology at Mount Royal University in Calgary. He was born and raised as a kid in Palestine under Israeli occupation. Good morning, Mohanad. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. My pleasure to be with you here today.
Let's just start with your reflections on the fact that we have hit the six-month mark as we've been doing a full hour Palestine coverage here on this show almost the entire 6 months. And each guest, right, as time has dragged on, that I've asked the question to when October 7th happened and October 8th kicked in, could they have imagined that it would have dragged on this long? And their answer has been a resounding no. And here we are at 6 months. Your thoughts? What were your thoughts yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very difficult period for Palestinians everywhere, and certainly the most difficult for the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. Most of us wished, obviously, that it would never happen in the first place. Most of us hoped that it would not last 6 months and still ongoing, no end in sight. But that is the reality that we're facing. We have to continue to do everything that we can to stop it. I mean, the amount of suffering and death and destruction that we have witnessed over the last 6 months is defining of the 21st century. This is not something that happens every day. This is not something that happens every year. This is a major event in world history that will have repercussions for generations to come. And the focus should always be on the Palestinian people in Gaza right now. And on, like I said, doing everything we can to stop the genocide. What can I say? I'm in horror. It's still a horrific moment that won't end, it seems.
I want to tug on some of the threads that you just brought up, Mohanad. One is that this is the defining moment of the 21st century with ramifications worldwide. I mean, you know, our focus has definitely been on Palestine. We also know that there are genocides happening in the Congo and Sudan. We see people's movements for liberation in Haiti also being met with violent protests. Here in America, one of the things that we talk about is part of why the brutality of the state seems to be increasing, has absolutely increased, is because white supremacy is taking its last breaths and knows that when you corner an animal in a cage, it fights back. Wondering if you see any of the similar reflections about Zionism, knowing that it is taking its last breath, particularly as it looks at unprecedented global response in solidarity with Palestinian liberation, something that we've never seen before.
Yes. And so let me first just clarify one thing, because this is really important. There are, of course, the genocides that you're referring to in the Congo, in Sudan. There's mass political violence being committed across the world for a very long time, including, of course, in the 21st century. But one of the reasons that I say that this might become the defining feature, it's not to rank the level of violence. I don't do that.
Of course not.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. But it is to highlight that the very nature of how this is unfolding and the relative speed in which this massive destruction is happening in a very small territory, combined with the global attention it has received, is one of the main reason why I say it might come to mark the 21st century. Because it is shaping people's political consciousness. This is a much deeper change than people than we can really predict. Where that will go. When I say it changes people's political consciousness, I mean people are changing the way in which they look at the oppressive structures in which they live. And they're starting to ask very serious questions about things like the state, their own states, things like international law, things like the imperial world order, things like U.S. imperialism, things like Israeli settler colonialism. These are becoming foundational questions on people's minds everywhere. And it's shaping how people now perceive politics and the world, resistance, aspirations for freedom and liberation. The consequences of such a shift in political consequences are impossible to calculate or predict. And this shift in political consciousness is desperately needed. So let me emphasize that. It is a good thing that it's happening, and it is desperately needed. Because we have come to a bit of a stagnant sort of state in terms of imagining a radical new world and what that might look like. And I'm hoping that this revitalization of this political consciousness, which never disappeared, of course, it always existed in movements within the United States, within Canada, across the globe, in Palestine, in South Africa, where I'm currently a visiting scholar, it has never disappeared, but it's becoming more widespread. And it needs to be widespread in order for real radical change to happen. And we do desperately need that. There is a strong feeling out there by many scholars that this is the beginning of the end for Zionism. That the Zionist project no longer can use its usual propaganda to conceal its reality. So many people around the world today, they hear Israeli propaganda and they just roll their eyes and move on because they know it's a bunch of BS. They don't buy. They see the reality and then they see the talk and they go, this doesn't add up. I know this is not nonsense. This is propaganda. So that's a good thing. Anytime reality is revealed, it's a good thing. But we still have a long way to go, in terms of the end of the Zionist project. I still always like to think about this in terms of, immediate term, intermediate term, and long term. I think in the long term, it is the correct analysis that this is the beginning of the end. But that beginning of the end could take a very, very, very long time. And everything that I'm seeing right now on the horizon suggests that the beginning of the end, that the end is going to take a very long time to happen. Because in the immediate term, nothing is changing. The genocide has continued. We're talking about 6 months already. And, it was within the first couple that Israel's propaganda machine stopped working as well as it usually does. In the intermediate term, we see all sorts of plans being formulated by elites, by powerful actors in the U.S., in Israel, in the Arab world, by regimes in the Arab world that are determined to betray the aspirations of the Palestinian people for freedom and liberation. And I fear that those plans will be carried forward and cause more harm and more destruction and more suffering for the Palestinian people in the intermediate term. But in the long term, that transformation in political consciousness that I started this answer with should yield to a serious blow to the Zionist project and to Israeli settler colonialism, and I hope as well, American imperialism.
Yeah, you said, scholars worldwide. I would say also organizers and activists worldwide. Lots of us have stood in solidarity with Palestine for quite some time and understood the importance of intersectionality, international struggle for international liberation. And I think that one of the things, when I look at Biden's resistance, even though we see it impacting his potential for being reelected, I think one of the reasons why powers, worldwide are sort of digging in their heels here is because they're clear, should Palestine get free? What does that inspire for freedom fighters across the globe? And Palestinian resistance has long been an inspiration for many of us. Today, the Palestinian Authority's request to be accepted as a full member of the United Nations is set to come before the Security Council for an initial debate. What does that mean, both in theory and practice, from where you sit?
It's a largely symbolic move. You know, so let's kind of take a step back. Okay, so what does it mean to recognize a Palestinian state? Well, for Israel, at least prior to this turn to the very fascist right, pretended to want to see the establishment of a Palestinian state. It was all pretense, but at least they pretended to do it. And what that meant for the Israelis, and also what it meant for the US, Canada, and Western European countries, is that there would be this self-administrative unit called the Palestinian state, but it would not enjoy any full rights of self-determination. It would not have a military. It would not necessarily be territorially contiguous. It would not have a say over its access to its own resources. It would be more or less an authority that is under the ultimate control of the Israeli state. So it's not a state at all. It's just a self-administrative entity that would be subservient to the Israeli state. That's how Israel also understood it. Now Israel doesn't even pretend to want that even. They're just flat out saying, no state, no sovereignty, get out of our faces. We just want you gone. Now, during that exact same time, when countries in the global south talked about a Palestinian state, they meant different things. I'm talking about countries like China, South Africa, Arab countries even, Turkey, Brazil, and others. When they talked about a Palestinian state, they didn't talk about it in the same way as the Americans and the Canadians and the British do, and the Israelis. They talked about it as a state with full rights of self-determination. So those are two very different ideas of a Palestinian state. What the Palestinian state is trying to, the Palestinian Authority is trying to do is basically, they're talking the game of full rights of self-determination, but they know full well that the people that they're begging for the state for the state recognition from, like the Americans, are not interested in that. So what's the point of doing this other than some symbolic victory that they want to, go back to the Palestinian people with and go, see, we're not as useless as you say we are. But in practical terms, yeah, I mean, let's just be clear.
Well, that was the next place I was going to go.
No, I mean, the Palestinian Authority enjoys very, very limited validity and legitimacy with the Palestinian people. I would say, I wouldn't trust polls on this. I would say that the majority of the Palestinian people want to completely, radically transform the Palestinian Authority or get rid of it altogether. Ultimately, all of this talk about the Palestinian state is going to be merely symbolic. There's only one real path of action that can be taken to fight for the Palestinian right for real sovereignty, real freedom, real self-determination, and that is the political and economic isolation of the Israeli state. There is no other way of accomplishing Palestinian aspirations for liberation and freedom unless the Israelis are forced to accept that outcome. And that can only happen with material consequences being placed on the Israeli state. So listen, I forget the Security Council, what's going to happen there, because we more or less know what's going to happen there, which is nothing, because the Americans won't let it. But Spain, under their government, yes, socialist government, they're planning to recognize the state of Palestine sometime this summer. That's a welcome first step. I'm not going to call it nothing. Yeah, it'll have some symbolic value. Great. I'm glad they're doing that. But on its own, it will do nothing to change anything on the ground, because Israel is comfortable taking these symbolic losses. They have to pay a material price for their genocide. Unless they are paying a material price, they will not stop it. And they will continue. So that kind of pressure on the Israeli state is completely lacking, completely missing from the conversation, but that is precisely what is needed in this moment.
I was going to ask my guest last week about Spain making that move. I guess I have a couple of questions. I mean, Spain's government isn't all that liberal either these days. However, I wonder, could something like that and urge other countries to do something similar, creating a snowball effect that maybe could lead to some material pressuring put on Israel.
So that's how activists should take these announcements, right? Activists should go, okay, this is a first step. We push the government enough to at least do that, but now we've got to push harder and go for the next thing. So look, that's why I don't discount the symbolic significance of moves like this. But that's, you know, then it's incumbent on activists for us to continue and to continue putting pressure on governments to move towards that material isolation of the Israeli state. Now, the cascading effect, the snowball effect, that is precisely what Israel fears the most. So let me take you, for example, to the recent announcement in Canada, the motion, the non-binding motion that was passed in Canada to halt exports of arms to Israel. This was a very watered down motion from the original one. The original one that was put by the New Democratic Party, the NDP, Heather McPherson, the MP, put forward a strong motion that included language about a full arms embargo on Israel. And the Liberal Party watered it down and they just say, no more authorization of new permits of exports to Israel. And they've already been doing that since January, the Liberal government. So basically the motion is doing nothing other than a symbolic gesture towards Canada sending Israel a symbolic gesture saying, You're becoming too much. We can't unconditionally support you if you do this too much like that. But there's no real injury to you. There's no material injury to you. It's just a symbolic message. We need to move this to material level. We need to move from these kinds of symbolic gestures to an actual full two-way embargo. Now, Canada on its own, people will go, well, Canada makes up, I think the number that I looked at, 0.05% of Israel's total exports of arms. So in effect, it would not actually have an effect. Sure, Canada on its own doesn't. But if Canada does it, maybe then Spain does it. Maybe then Ireland does it. Maybe then Italy does it. If Italy does it, you're moving now from a 0.05 to something like a 4.7%. I can't remember the exact number for Italy, but you're moving a bit closer. And maybe if then they start to form a large coalition of middle powers that is sending a clear message in the international arena that business with Israel will not go on anymore as usual, then the big players like Germany, like the US, will have to take that into account when they decide on their own policies when it comes to these questions. So the snowball effect is a real possibility, is a real thing. There is a reason why the Israeli state fears it. You can see it in the commentary over the motion that was passed in Canada that, people were saying things like, well, this is not going to affect Israel right now, but what if this becomes a movement that they are scared of? And they should be, because if you're determined to carry out a settler colonial genocide, you should be afraid of a cascading, snowballing global reaction against you. And so that's what we should be driving from the grassroots level, is for that cascading sort of snowballing movement where states start to take serious concrete action. And if something like this does take off, Israeli settler colonial genocide will stop. Believe me, trust me, it will stop. Material isolation, economic, political isolation does work. So this has to be the path that we all pursue wherever we are around the world, whether it's in South Africa, in Brazil, in the US, in Canada, in the UK, Germany, anywhere in the world, China, everybody on the ground should be pushing for the material isolation of the Israeli state, because that is the only way to stop this genocide once and for all.
For those of you just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We're in conversation with Mohanad Ayash, a policy analyst for Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, and a professor of sociology at Mount Royal University in Calgary. Speaking of what may just be purely symbolic goings on, there are truce talks happening in Cairo. The press in Egypt says progress is being made, but Israel denies it. Your thoughts on what, if any, progress could be made, and what a real truce? You just said a lot about material pressure on Israel. I guess when I'm thinking of truce, like what would happen? It's hard for me to even wrap my mind around it right at this point in time when there's been so much damage and destruction. But what would truce, is that even the right word, look like?
Yeah. So in terms of what's happening, you know, I have as much insight as anybody else would. In fact, what we're hearing is that the Israelis and Hamas are both keeping it a very, you know, closely guarded secret as to whether or not they believe that this could lead into an actual agreement or not. Most analysts are saying, as far as I can see, that the next 48 hours will be crucial, that there is a real possibility, of an agreement, but that anything could happen in the next 48 hours that will make it, you know, where the agreement doesn't come into fruition. Anything can happen to stop the momentum, I guess, towards the agreement. So it's hard to say. There are contextual factors that suggest that this might be a little different, and maybe there is a little extra pressure on Israel to agree to some kind of ceasefire. But we'll wait and see. Now, what does a real ceasefire and, you know, let's, yeah, I don't know if truce is the right word, but what would a real ceasefire agreement look like? Well, anything that would be fair and just would involve the immediate, of course, halt and stop of all military operations, the complete and unconditional withdrawal of all Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip, the opening of the opening of all, you know, all of the points in the siege where aid can flow in, the unconditional entering of all aid workers and aid and equipment that is necessary to begin in earnest and immediately and with full throttle, the resuscitation of the Gaza Strip, rebuilding its infrastructure, rebuilding its residential areas and so on. And of course, if there was any justice in the world, the Israeli state would be the one paying for all of it. It would, of course, involve the release of all the hostages and the release of Palestinian hostages being held by the Israeli state. There's of course much more detail to all of that that we can get into, but those for me would be the contours of any kind of just resolution at the moment, and that would be just the first step of a real negotiations process for a real sovereignty for the Palestinian people, and negotiations that would lead to what I would call shared sovereignty of the land between Palestinians and Israelis in the long term. You know, I know I'm putting a lot on there, but if you ask me what is a real and just framework looks like, I have to give you that answer, because that is what would be needed. But unfortunately, in this context, we're going to be settling for much, much less than all of that. What the Israeli state is still committed to do in this operation is to drive as many Palestinians out of Gaza as possible, to colonize as much land in the Gaza Strip as possible. And they have a number of different plans to pursue that end goal, not all of which, by the way, include this immediate mass expulsion of Palestinians. So that is one of the options that they wish would come about, is that literally over a million Palestinians would just leave Gaza very quickly and be set up in refugee camps in Sinai or elsewhere, and for the Israeli forces to come and begin colonizing and settling that land with Israeli Jews and declaring it Israeli territory and so on. But that does not seem likely to me to be the possible for them to achieve. But there are other ways they can work towards that. They can start to cut up the Gaza Strip into different districts, divide the north from the south, maybe even more than that, maybe divide it into four or five areas that themselves become discontiguous. And where, you know, Israeli checkpoints and walls and military infrastructure begin to be established in order to cut up the territory into these smaller fragments, where Israel then takes more land and turns that land into no-go areas, and basically turn the Gaza Strip then in all of those regions where people remain into very difficult areas for people to live and make a living, and then people slowly leave. That's still, I think, something that they would like to see happen. So don't mistake what the Israeli goal is. It's settler colonialism. It's to expel the Palestinians from their land and replace them with Israeli Jews and establish Israeli Jewish sovereignty over the entire land from the river to the sea. That is their goal. They're working towards it through stages, through different plans and different techniques. So that's why I go back to the material isolation of the Israeli state. That's the only way to get them off that path. There's no other way. There's only one other way, which is war. And that will happen as well if the expulsion of the Palestinians is allowed to happen. They will come back, and they will come back with a strong army. Not all of it will be just Palestinians. This could take many generations, sure, but it will happen. So I don't see a third way. It's either genocide and war, or the political and economic isolation of the Israeli state, which can lead to real discussions about creating an alternative form of living together on the land. But that's where things stand at the moment. There are multiple scenarios still on the table, and most of them are not very peaceful or just for the Palestinian people.
Mohamed Ayash, according to the Washington Post, Israel said yesterday, the 6 month mark of this iteration of genocide, that it was withdrawing all but one brigade from the south of the enclave, describing it as an opportunity for troops to rest and retool for the next chapter of war. They said they had completed their mission, air quotes, in the south, and were now going basically to rest for the Rafah invasion. What does it mean in practical terms that they've completed their mission in the south? What are the material conditions that they leave behind is part one of the question. And then part two, we were talking about things that could interrupt the truce talks in Cairo. And we know that they're bombing Rafah now. I don't want to pretend that Rafah is just sitting there untouched. But for them to move forward with, you know, their stated plans for a full-on invasion of Rafah.
Yes. So, look, I mean, it's always difficult to answer these military type questions as the fighting is still happening, as the operation is still in full scale go mode. What the Israelis themselves are saying is that this is not a final withdrawal. This is just simply to, refurbish their forces and get prepared for the next attack. So if they say that, I'm going to believe them that is what they plan to do. Now, what did they do? They destroyed life. This is what the operation is. So many military analysts say that the militarily Israel is losing because Hamas continues to fight. They have not been able to eradicate Hamas. And yes, from a military perspective, that is correct. But I'm not sold that is, in fact, the Israeli state's actual goal was to eradicate Hamas. I think their actual goal in the operation has always been to make the land uninhabitable for the Palestinian population. Their attack was always on civilians, first and foremost. And you can see that in the sheer destruction and the sheer number of civilians killed. And you know, if you're going after a fighting group, you're not destroying all the hospitals, all the universities, all the schools, all the bakeries, all the agricultural fields, the water, sanitation, et cetera, et cetera. You're not doing that. When you do all of that, you're doing that to make life uninhabitable for the people. So this was always an operation directed against the Palestinian people, not Hamas. So what did they accomplish? They made life very difficult in the land, almost uninhabitable for the Palestinians. There's nothing left for them to destroy, I suppose. That's why they withdrew back. But they say they're coming back. So I believe them that they are going to come back and launch another assault on the Palestinian people in Khan Yunis and in other parts. And in Rafah, they have also said, they've made it very clear that the plan to attack Rafah is still on. They said that this morning. So it's nothing has changed in their mind, despite all of this increasing international pressure, because all of this international pressure is still merely symbolic. So that's why they don't feel the need to change. Now, some could read this as well as part of this perhaps momentum towards some kind of ceasefire agreement, that this withdrawal is giving an opening to that. Maybe that is perhaps true. We'll find out altogether very soon. I can't predict for you one way or the other. But even if there is a ceasefire agreement, like I said, if it doesn't involve complete withdrawal of the Israeli forces and allowing aid to come in and the reconstruction of Gaza to commence without any hindrance, then that tells me that they are still basically planning to make life uninhabitable or the land uninhabitable for Palestinian life. So this is where we remain today, and we have to be extremely vigilant and extremely careful about how we read all these developments, and not fall into traps where we're lulled into thinking that the fighting is over and we need to move on now and move on to this next topic. I mean, that's what the Biden administration desperately wants to happen for electoral reasons, for electoral reasons, not moral reasons. We have to be vigilant against that and insist that such a ceasefire does not signal the end of Palestinian suffering, and we have to insist on. Using this moment to put real pressure, material pressure on the Israeli state. I keep going back to that.
Just a couple more questions. You are a professor of sociology. I recently had the pleasure of speaking to Maya Wind about her new book, which looks at the complicity of Western higher education, support of the Israeli occupation, as well as the ways in which the system or institution of Israeli higher education is actually a tool of oppression and Zionism. Wondering your thoughts there, but mostly as we reflect on the last 6 months and all of the bombing of every institution of learning in Gaza, what does this mean for students, for learning? For Rahab Nizal has been a regular guest on the show, trying to teach in the West Bank. What does this mean for students, for learning, for the development of the next generation of professionals, artists, engineers, teachers, etc.? And how is that intentional destruction of these places of learning an intentional strategy of Israel to break or wipe out Palestinians, if you will?
It is absolutely an intentional, deliberate strategy. They are deliberately targeting not just the institutions, as in like the buildings themselves that have been destroyed, the research labs that have been destroyed, the cultural sites, archives, and so on. But they're also killing professors. They're killing deans. They're killing university professors, presidents. They're killing students. It is an intentional, deliberate attempt at what I would call epistemicide. The destruction of the some scholars refer to it as scholasticide, to refer to the direct attack against academia, but I like epistemicide because it's a much broader term. They actually would like to see the end of Palestinian knowledge producing institutions like universities and like schools. The Israeli state, like I said, its foundation is settler colonial, which means it has to eliminate the indigenous population, Palestinian population. That doesn't always mean necessarily just physical elimination. And physical elimination can take on varied forms. It could be killing. It could also be expulsion. Expulsion is the main, actually, form of Israeli violence against the Palestinian people. And it also means not just the physical bodies of Palestinians, but their very epistemology, their very knowledge, their very history, their very existence as a people. That is part of Israel's quote-unquote target list. They don't want Palestinians to exist as a political people with a history, with political sovereign rights to the land. So that involves attacking their ability to produce knowledge about themselves, to produce knowledge that will help them enhance their lives. So it's not just the social sciences and the humanities and the arts, which is how we tell our story about ourselves and discover ourselves and advance ourselves as a collective, but also the technological sciences, the physical sciences that also enhance Palestinian life, that produce Palestinian engineers and architects and statisticians and you name it. The Palestinian people are actually one of the most educated people in the Middle East and even in the world. And the people of Gaza have extremely high levels of education, thanks to a robust educational infrastructure, but also just ingrained in the culture of Palestinians is to arm yourself with education, to strengthen yourself and the cause of the Palestinian people with education. So that it is a source of strength and pride for the Palestinians, which is why Israel deliberately attacks it. Just to give you one example, some of the doctors and surgeons that have been assassinated by the Israeli state in this operation, you're talking about people who spent 15, 20, 30 years specializing in a specific area of medicine. When you kill those people, you're setting back the Palestinian society in a very serious way. You can't just retrain 10 surgeons in an area of medicine that needs 15 years of study to, you know, become a surgeon in. You can't just replace that. So you know, the reconstruction of the strip is going to take a very long time, and there are certain aspects of it that cannot be replaced anytime soon, because of this deliberate attack on Palestinian higher learning, on Palestinian knowledge, on Palestinian knowledge producing and research institutions. I mean, it's beyond my ability to even communicate how devastating all of this is. And the students that have completely lost not just a year of education. I mean, let me take you back to COVID times when many people in Canada and the US were worried sick about their children's future because of 2 or 3 months off of their education. Imagine now what Palestinian children are going through. We're not just talking about a full year of education lost. We're talking about students whose half of their classmates have been killed. Their schools no longer exist. Their teachers have been killed. Their principals have been killed. So take whatever feeling you had during COVID about your children's future, times it by 100, and that will start to give you some kind of sense of the challenge that Palestinians are now looking at. It's enormous. The challenges are enormous. But I believe in the Palestinian people. We will come through this. We will be our resilience. Our sumud will come through. We will rebuild. But it's going to take many years, and we need people to support us. We need people from across the world to support us, and that starts with the isolation of the Israeli state.
Ahmed Ayash, thank you so much for this conversation. I've got to leave it there. Definitely, we'll have you back on the show.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world for all of us to thrive in. That's it for this episode, fam. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programming is funded exclusively by listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Remember, we all we got.